You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from UBC, located on the unceded traditional Coast Salish territory of the Musqueam people. Hello, and welcome to Intersections, presented by the Gender Empowerment Collective. This radio show is presented every 4 weeks, where we dig into topics about gender, race, and social justice. We open our show with a conversation between your hosts, followed by an interview with an expert on the topic that we will be discussing. Hi, my name is Randy. Welcome to Intersections. Today we're talking about the misconceptions of human trafficking and how they have the potential to harm sex workers.
Hi, my name's Maddie.
And hi, my name's Anastasia, and we're going to start this episode off with talking about some definitions. Sex trafficking is forced sex in which women are forced by violence to engage in sex. And that is the definitions that I found in my research.
Yeah, I actually found it really interesting diving into more about what human trafficking and sex work was. I do admit, like, when I first hear about human trafficking, my mind immediately goes to that Taken movie with Liam Neeson, and like the young, beautiful, rich girl gets like taken away from his privileged life and gets sold into this seedy sex industry and his drugs, and it's like just dark and gross, kind of. You got that whole image, but actually diving into it, human trafficking takes so many different forms. It is not even just sex trafficking. There's labor trafficking and all sorts of different ways that people can kind of be taken about against their will. And it's really glad we're talking about it, because I think these movies and all this stuff in the media and all everything you hear isn't necessarily reflective of what is happening in the world, and it can really negatively impact sex workers as well. Many of them, like, is consensual. Sex trafficking is non-consensual, human trafficking is non-consensual, and sex work is consensual in many instances, and it's a great career for many people. So I'm really glad that we're talking about this and dispelling a lot of myths.
Yeah, I think the more we talked about this episode, the more we settled on its importance. And similar to you, Maddie, my exposure to understandings of sex trafficking and human trafficking are largely driven by thriller movies, action movies, and it definitely takes a very specific form as to what sex trafficking is. Moving on with the segment, we're going to talk about different research articles that we came across. So in my research, I found this article in The Local, and it's talking about how different laws make sex work less safe. So this article is about Canada, and it's talking about different prostitution laws and how they impact sex workers. One of the major things in this article that I found interesting was talking about different zoning laws. So the article talks about how, this is specifically in Toronto, and talks about these places, they call them, quote, body rub parlors. So these are businesses that offer erotic massages, and they suffer very intense zoning laws, which means they're basically relegated and forced to the outside of, like, the populous parts of cities. So, for example, they can't be close to churches. I believe they can't be close to schools as well. So they're kind of relegated to what I would call, like, industrial areas of Toronto. So putting this much physical separation between the populous part of the city and where a lot of these sex workers are performing their labor puts them in harm's way. A couple things that I was thinking about as to why this is that, you know, like, when you think about when you're walking down, like, a really populated street, it tends to give you, like, a sense of safety in some way, because, you know, there's all these people around. There's just, like, more happening. And I think you feel that, like, you know, there are people, versus, you know, in industrial areas where, like, people are only there from, say, like, you know, 7 a.m. to 6 p.m. After those hours, you know, they're not out and about. And also, even during the day, they're not walking around. So, yeah, that's something that I thought was really interesting, is how these zoning laws work. to harm sex workers. And then the other thing that it talked about that I think is related to this is it talked about a law that was passed in Canada. So it's Bill C-36. So it's Protection of Communities and Exploited Persons Act. And they describe in this article that the goal of this bill was to eliminate the sex work industry. And I think this, again, goes into this idea about how, you know, people outside of the sex work industry that have little to no understanding of it, view it as something that, you know, it's a problem, it needs to go away. And again, that's not necessarily like helping people who are part of the sex work industry. And I think that relates to these zoning laws, because if you think about it, it's a way for the cities to kind of push it out, and they can take it away from, like, you know, their image. It doesn't have to, they can pretend that it's not happening in their city. So yeah, it's another way to relegate it to a sphere outside of their city.
Yeah, that classic, if you just make it illegal, the problem will just go away. And what, then human trafficking will stop? yeah, I feel like that's such a classic misinformed theory. Like, I know in New Zealand, they decriminalized prostitution, I think it was 2003. And then 5 years afterwards, they did a survey because it was legal. That meant people, like, one of the issues with sex human trafficking and sex trafficking is like the inconsistencies of data. And so because it's an illegal profession, sex work. And so in New Zealand, when they decriminalized it and people were able to actually like report any abuse, 5 years later, they found there was no instances of trafficking because people could actually report it and kind of nip these illegal things in the butt, and essentially, like, I don't know, just like making it legal makes it safer. So anyway, I get all like up in arms when people are like, we should just push it to the sides of society and make it more illegal, then that will solve all of this.
Yeah, that actually, a lot of what you're saying, Randy, really relates to the article that I explored by, the article is called Innocent White Victims and Fallen Black Girls, Race, Sex Work, and the Limits of Anti-Sex Trafficking Laws. And yeah, what you're saying about them being pushed out into unsafe neighborhoods disproportionately affects Black girls and Black women. Like, there are more white women who are in actually indoor prostitution and more Black women in outdoor prostitution. And actually, like, the Black youth that are who are arrested for prostitution it's like 62%, which is found in 2015. And so they're being criminalized at a higher rate, and they're also being put in unsafe environments compared to white girls. But these anti-trafficking laws, which already don't affect anybody in sex work or trafficking victims, it doesn't help either of them. It disproportionately affects Black women because they are already targets of being arrested, and they're already put in a lot more unsafe situations, and the trafficking laws don't acknowledge this at all. But still, the zoning is definitely a problem, because then people don't want sex work in their neighborhood, and so they're still pushed out to the edges, like you talked about, Randy. So yeah, that's what I found in my from the article that I read.
Yeah, I think this is relating to what you were saying, but when you're talking about like the role that racialized women who are part of the sex work industry, the role that policing plays in their experience with the industry, I found a bit of this, and similar to what you found in your research, women of color who are sex workers are disproportionately targeted by police. Whether that's being arrested, receiving fines or threats or harassment from the police. They talk about in the article that I read about how, you know, like this contradiction of how police are supposed to be there to make you feel safe. So like they talk about an instance in one of these parlors where like a man came in and I think stabbed two or three of the women that were there, and one of them unfortunately died. And yeah, so they talk about like how police are supposed to make you feel safe, but at the same time, you know, police are the ones who are harassing them and hurting them. And I think it brings up the relationship that police have to sex work, And like, I think the understanding that a lot of like, I guess, law enforcement, the same ways that, you know, like we have thought of sex work and sex trafficking as similar to same things. Yeah, like when the laws are equating them, or like, you know, it is an illegal practice, all of these things make it so that this person, you know, and again, we already have this understanding of how people of color are treated by police and their experiencing with policing. And so when you tack on something like that, that's seen, you know, these people are seen as breaking the laws, and then, you know, but they're also supposed to be seen as victims of sex trafficking. And then like what you said, Anastasia, but, you know, Black women are not granted this, like they're not seen as victims, you know, no matter how young or what their experience is. So I think it, yeah, it brings up this interesting conversation about the role that policing has in this understanding in our society of sex work and sex trafficking.
That's a really great quote. And you both mentioned something about it before, like trying to get people to support just like anti-trafficking, essentially. Mm-hmm. So like, I found this great quote online to like support what is so much more marketing towards like anti-sex trafficking rather than like support sex workers. And the quote is, framing the campaign's key target as sexual slavery might garner more support and less resistance, while framing the campaign as combating prostitution may be less likely to mobilize similar levels of support and to stimulate stronger opposition. So like the story is just like,
yeah, no, that is interesting. Correct me if I'm wrong, but that's kind of, to me, when you read it, it sounds like it's alluding to like, to garner more support, you have to use certain language, and the language that garners more impact in people is talking about trafficking. Is that?
Yeah, that's probably a good way to interpret it, and kind of like segues into a bit of what I found as well, which is kind of, as we spoke to earlier in the show, we're saying that like our interpretation, I think when we first think of sex trafficking, is that Taken movie. And one of the reasons that people's mind originally goes to that is because that sells, like, and awful stories about young white girls being taken away by these terrible captors taken across state lines or across different countries are more likely to get people's interest. Yeah, I kind of found that, so sex trafficking, I mean, sorry, human trafficking does actually include labor trafficking and sex trafficking, and labor trafficking doesn't get presented much in the media at all, and global experts do actually think that it's just a far higher, yeah, so I'll just start that again. So human trafficking does actually include both sex trafficking and labor trafficking, but you don't hear about labor trafficking much at all. And actually worldwide, experts believe there are more situations of labor trafficking than of sex trafficking, but there's just so much more of a wider awareness about sex trafficking than of.
Yeah. Addie, what you were saying about how like, you know, the role that media plays, you touched like a bit about, and like, you know, the movie Taken, I think again, that's like what we picture. And it just makes me think of, yeah, like the sensational, like, how a lot of our news is so sensational. Like, I actually just read this book and it's sort of related, but it's talking about troll culture and how closely troll culture is our mainstream culture. And one of the main things it talked about is the way that Fox News would feed off these stories that trolls made for like a joke. Like these stories, you know, they were meant to make them laugh, and then Fox News would take it and they'd run with it. And I think that can be so easily related to what we see in the way that media and news companies talk about human trafficking, specifically sex trafficking.
Yeah, absolutely. When I was looking through studies, I just found like, looking through articles, I just found countless articles talking about these just wildly sensationalist and factually incorrect stories about sex trafficking. So just a few of them I found, there was one in Dallas that said, in Houston alone, about 300,000 sex trafficking cases are prosecuted each year. And this got taken up by like a whole bunch of news outlets. So this one outlet said it and then just got repeated on and on. And then it was either like a detective or an independent reporter looked into it. And it turns out they had two. They have two sex trafficking cases prosecuted each year, which like not 200,000, just two. And then when they actually reported back to the original media, the sort of this Dallas news site, they didn't update. All they did was remove that 300,000 number. They didn't like put two in there or even like re-release it. They just like took it away quietly. And then in like 2009, I found that CNN reported, like, as a matter of fact, the most common form of human trafficking is sexual exploitation. And then this article says, but the network failed to mention the critical information that immediately followed the study statistic, that is more frequently reported. Sexual exploitation has become the most documented type of trafficking in aggregate statistics. In comparison, other forms of exploitation are underreported. So you very rarely hear about labor trafficking, which is like a huge part of human trafficking that is wildly known to be underreported and like significantly more than people think. And there's, yeah, I mean, I would be dubious that even if labor trafficking was, if there was more found out about it, whether the media would even put it out.
I think that's really, I think that's really interesting because, it's definitely just for, it is really sick how people love these horrible stories.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think it's all about the headlines, right? Like we constantly hear that, like, you know, certain headlines sell. And I think you'll see that, like what you were saying, Maddie, like using facts that aren't even real and then like making up facts and then going back and just erasing that, but then just leaving the article without like, you know, stating anything. That's one of the downfalls, right? Like a lot of, basically like all news companies, mainstream ones, they're businesses, they're corporations, you know, they're to turn a profit. You know, Facebook has been accused of like how, you know, they do advertising and stuff. Because the more clicks, like the more sensational, the more it shocks us and wows us, the more we're going to click on it. And it leads to so much more misinformation about sex trafficking.
Yeah. And it's just like even researching for this show, you can't Google human trafficking without finding sex trafficking. Like it's really hard to pull apart like those two pieces. If there's just more information out there, there's going to be more misconception of what actually is happening. And if everyone's putting the term sex trafficking, if everyone's hearing that, like those two words are too different from sex work and how they sound. And people are going to start thinking that sex work is all about coercion and force and being taken away. I don't know what to say that because actually looking through this, a lot of human trafficking happens within people aren't necessarily removed from their home to be human trafficked either. I can't even talk about it without saying taken. Like it's just so ingrained in our thoughts and conceptions of this. And I think one thing I also found is that there's just no consistent data.
Yeah, I think obviously there's so much more we can say on this. But I hope everybody got something out of this conversation, whether it's us having this conversation or listening to it. And please stay tuned. Following this, we'll have an interview with another one of our collective members, with the executive director of SWAN, which is an organization based in Vancouver. So thank you all for listening.
Thank you.
Celebrating human ingenuity, resilience, and grit. Tell a Story Hive's Game Changers Documentary Edition is here. Calling all local emerging filmmakers in BC and Alberta, StoryHive is offering 30 grants of $20,000 each to capture stories of local game changers that are making their community a better place. Send in your application to storyhive.com/apply by November 10th. If you have a story to share, we want to hear from you.
Tune in to Too Dreamy, Fridays from 1 to 2 p.m. on CITR, featuring music from local female and non-binary musicians and some sweet bedroom pop tunes.
All
Right. So hello, my name is Peyton, and the focus of today's episode is misconceptions about human trafficking and how they have the potential to harm sex workers. I'm joined by Allison Clancy from Vancouver-based organization SWAN. Thank you for joining us today.
It's my pleasure to be here.
Amazing. So just to begin, you can just go ahead and introduce yourself and your role with SWAN, and then just give us an idea of what SWAN is all about, what your mission is.
Yeah, sure. So I'm the executive director. I've been with the organization since 2012. Started as a volunteer and then just had different roles in the organization until finally I was the executive director. So SWAN, as the organization, it supports newcomer, migrant, and immigrant women who do indoor sex work, and we support them through providing direct services and systemic advocacy.
Awesome. Yeah, so the focus of today's episode is really just related to human trafficking. And the reason we wanted to focus on this is we know that your organization does a lot of work around human trafficking, not just in protecting those who are victims of human trafficking, but also sort of examining the ways that we think about it and how misconceptions about it can harm sex workers in some ways. So how does SWAN actually define human trafficking? And in your work, what do you find to be like the most common misconceptions about it?
Okay, so SWAN uses the United Nations definition of human trafficking, which involves a means and act for the purpose of trafficking. So the means can include anything such as harboring a person, receiving a person, transporting a person through acts of violence, abuse of power, threats, extortion, and it's for the purpose of exploitation. So that can be sexual exploitation or labor exploitation. When it comes to anti-trafficking, there's a lot of misperceptions in society. There's a lot of people that may not be aware of the complexities of the sex industry, and they see the entire sex industry as being women who are being exploited or that they are being trafficked. In reality, with the women who access SWAN services, so again, that's newcomer, migrant, or immigrant women involved in sex work, we rarely see cases of human trafficking. I would say on average, we probably get calls to address human trafficking once a year, once every 2 years. So the numbers are really, really low. But that's not to say that we don't do a lot of trafficking prevention. So we work with women to work on other issues related to violence or exploitation and prevent them from becoming human trafficking cases. I think it's just really unfortunate that a lot of society sees, particularly the women that come to SWAN, for services as trafficking victims, when really it's a other whole host of issues that those women are addressing in their lives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my next question was going to be regarding how sex work and human trafficking are conflated very, very often. So in really like concrete terms, like how would you say that the two are distinct from each other?
Mm-hmm. So sex work is the exchange of various sexual services for money or other goods, and it involves varying degrees of consent, whereas human trafficking, there is no consent and a person is being exploited in a situation. So a situation could start out as involvement in the sex trade and of course take a turn for the worse and turn into human trafficking, but they are very, very different issues. Human trafficking as well, or the way that it's talked about in society, unfortunately often doesn't involve trans or gender diverse or non-binary folks or male sex workers. So the trafficking discourse is largely centered on women in the sex industry.
Mm-hmm. Your work is mainly focused on migrant women. So how are these misconceptions about trafficking, how are they particularly impacted by them?
Yeah, so I think the trafficking narrative that society is more familiar with is really based on systemic racism. It's an assumption that racialized women, which is the majority of the women that SWAN supports, don't have agency, are voiceless, are passive, and that hasn't been our experience whatsoever. These are strong, resilient women to work in an industry with few labor or legal protections. So how trafficking initiatives and campaigns harm the women who access SWAN services is, firstly, it misrepresents them, and that's throughout society, whether it's in the media, on the evening news, in movies, newspaper articles. And it also creates stigma because it misrepresents them as something that they're not. And then a lot of the initiatives that are created are part of what we call part of the rescue industry. So there's a general assumption that these women need to be rescued from the sex industry. And that leads to a whole host of very harmful and oppressive approaches, particularly by law enforcement. So what SWAN has been dealing with for many, many years are rescues and raids carried out by law enforcement, which in law enforcement would, let's say bust into a massage business and try to rescue women from the sex industry. You can imagine how traumatic that would be for anybody in their workplace, that you're sitting there doing your job and then suddenly the door busts open and here you have armed police officers rushing in to rescue you when you weren't asked to be rescued. So that creates a lot of fear of police, distrust, and an adversarial relationship, so that if women in the sex industry actually do experience some type of violence, which let's say robbery is much more common, or things like sexual assault or physical assault, they're certainly not going to call upon those same police officers that had traumatized them through a raid and rescue. So unfortunately, lots of people in society donate money and support carceral feminist approach to anti-trafficking. And what that does is actually it creates vulnerability to human trafficking because it creates barriers to coming forward and reporting the other types of violence that sex workers are actually experiencing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's related to that Operation Northern Spotlight. I noticed that was mentioned on your website. Is that sort of what you're talking about there?
Yeah. So Operation Northern Spotlight for several years was a national police enforcement approach. So it involved these raids and rescues on massage businesses. And then in later years, it involved police officers catfishing sex workers. So going online, pretending to be clients of sex workers, police setting up in hotel rooms. And then when sex workers visited the hotel rooms, they were again, traumatized by walking into a room of unarmed police officers who were there to save them. So in recent years, it hasn't been as much of a coordinated national approach by law enforcement. Locally, we have seen that the enforcement of those raids and rescues against licensed massage businesses have decreased. However, police attention have moved more to other venues where sex work occurs, like condos or private homes or micro brothels where two or three women may be working together. So in that way, police still carried out those raids and rescues, but it was much more under the radar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that kind of fosters a relationship where when they do actually need help from the police, I'm sure they don't really feel very safe to seek that help. Yeah. So my next question would be, what steps do you think the governments can take to protect that minority of people who are actually victims of human trafficking without jeopardizing the safety of sex workers who are engaging in the work consensually?
Mm-hmm. So that's a great question. The most important thing that the government could do to prevent trafficking would be to decriminalize the sex industry. And that's very complex for lots of folks to understand. Lots of folks think that decriminalizing the sex industry means it becomes just a free-for-all and there are no laws to protect sex workers. However, in actual fact, within the Criminal Code of Canada, already there exists every conceivable law that could address any type of violence against sex workers, such as extortion, sexual assault, physical assault, robbery. What the prostitution laws do in Canada is just simply make it more difficult for sex workers to protect themselves, for example, by working together. So, or working with others, such as a receptionist or a bodyguard or a driver. So those third parties, as they're called, they're criminalized. Advertising sexual services except for yourself is criminalized. So again, that creates an environment where violence can happen, because if you can't communicate what you are consenting to or what you will not consent to, or the services you will or will not provide, when someone shows up and then suddenly finds out, well, this is not what I came for and that's not what you offer, you can see that that could create an environment for violence. So what decriminalization means is removing the sex work laws, and what that would do would be enabling sex workers to access occupational health and safety and other employment laws and standards like anyone in any other occupation can avail of. So when they do find themselves in exploitative situations, or for example, situations where people are asking them to work without pay or work longer hours, they would have labor avenues to address those. So you can imagine in any occupation, if you had a labor issue and the police were who you were calling upon to resolve the issues between the person you were working for, that's not, I don't think that's advisable for anyone working in any job. So you can see what the issue would be there. So with criminalization, it just creates an environment where women will not come forward. And when more specifically with immigrant and migrant sex workers, they experience multi-layered criminalization. So I had talked about anti-trafficking laws and how they actually increase the vulnerability to sex, to trafficking and violence. Then you have the prostitution laws. And additionally, these women have immigration and refugee protection regulations, which any temporary resident in Canada, including international students or migrant workers or anyone here on a work permit, they cannot work in the sex industry. So coming forward to report violence, and we often see this, can result in them incriminating themselves on an immigration violation in which they are arrested, detained, and deported. So multi-layered criminalization is what the government really needs to look at if they were truly and genuinely interested in increasing the safety of sex workers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because the current circumstances pretty much leave them with nowhere to turn.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So in our experience at SWAN, when a migrant woman with precarious immigration status, for example, comes forward to report violence or exploitation or trafficking, there's only ever two things that happens to her. One is that she becomes the target of a prostitution investigation herself, or she is found to be in violation of the immigration regulations and policy or laws in Canada. So then she can be arrested, detained, or deported. So you can see that there's an enormous disincentive for women currently with the laws in Canada to come forward to report any violence that they're experiencing. So all of these laws, the trafficking laws, the prostitution laws, and the immigration laws have really been counterproductive, and again, just really increase that vulnerability to violence, exploitation, and trafficking.
The haunting debut album Black Moon by Civic TV provides a cinematic backdrop, a modern-day symphony of the dark and light that is our collective reality. Take a listen to Black Moon, now available via Flemish Eye Records and on all streaming platforms.
Individuals who experienced sexual misconduct as a member of the Canadian Armed Forces or as an employee of the Department of National Defence and or staff of the non-public funds Canadian Forces may qualify for financial compensation and participate in a restorative engagement program. Claims for financial compensation and the restorative engagement program must be filed by November 24, 2021. File a claim. Participate in restorative engagement. Be heard. File a claim at caf-dndsexualmisconductclassaction.ca.
We've also seen sort of repercussions of these misconceptions in like the realm of online sex work too lately, particularly like I've heard about companies such as MasterCard, which are refusing to have any payments related to sex work activity. Do you have anything to like say about that topic and how it's impacting sex workers?
Yeah, it's just really unfortunate that there's so much misinformation out there in society and so few people are able to differentiate sex work from human trafficking. So when you get credit card companies and banks, and then in collaboration with police and carceral feminists and faith-based organizations who all just view the entire sex industry as human trafficking, they implement all of these measures which attack sex workers on every possible angle. Sex workers, those working online, of course they need online financial transactions, but when that's shut down and when they can't do that, I mean, that cuts off their income and again places them in a situation where greater vulnerability is created.
Yeah, I heard all about that with the OnlyFans thing. It was a website that was pretty much essentially dedicated to sex work and where women were making a living from sex work. And essentially, until a last minute just like decision, the entire thing was basically going to be shut down, pretty much shutting down everyone's stream of income because of the MasterCard being unable to follow through those payments. So yeah, I thought that was pretty ridiculous and concerning, just like so demonstrative of the degree of which these misconceptions actually harm the women really need protection.
There's so many sex workers that work online, like they do camera work, like there's no physical interactions with anyone, but unfortunately there's misconception that any type of online sex work is human trafficking. So sex workers who work online have really experienced a lot of harm over the years, particularly with a number of online sites where they would work and advertise their services have been shut down. So it's just being attacked from every conceivable angle.
Mm-hmm. Another thing I wanted to touch on is not only do I feel like sex work and human trafficking are conflated in a dangerous way, I also think human trafficking in general, the way that we think about it and the narratives that are told about it aren't actually reflective of what it actually looks like a lot of the time. Like a lot of the time you'll go on social media and you'll see posts that are shared about girls saying, oh, this person approached me in a parking lot and it's a huge conspiracy of a sex trafficking ring. They're gonna drug you and put you in their car. And it's not actually reflective of how it actually works. You wanna maybe expand on what actual human trafficking would look like in real life? Cause I know it's a lot more subtle a lot of the time.
Yeah, unfortunately there's a lot of viral scare lore out there that spreads like wildfire, and it just fuels these myths about human trafficking. And then I think in connection with those, just a lot of really graphic anti-trafficking campaigns, and I certainly don't want in any way to minimize the violence that's involved with human trafficking when it does happen. However, when people, particularly criminal justice personnel, like judges, for example, come to understand human trafficking through this lens that, you know, a woman has to be really beaten and bruised, they're looking for that in the cases. So there was a study not too many years ago done by criminologists in BC who had actually interviewed criminal justice personnel who had worked on human trafficking cases. And because the judges were expecting to see that level of violence, and sometimes it's not there, then people weren't being, or the traffickers weren't being convicted. So it is having real life detrimental effects. What it can look like oftentimes is, you know, someone being exploited, their passport being taken. It may or may not involve violence, but it does involve like really egregious labor conditions. And the other thing that we need to think about as well is other types of labor trafficking outside of the sex industry that can happen at construction sites or with domestic service, like, for example, nannies or caretaking, agriculture. So there's so many other industries where trafficking happens and labor exploitation. However, it's sex trafficking that unfortunately gets all of the attention all of the time. And it's there's a lot of reasons why that happens. But I think for a lot of people to understand the sex industry as trafficking, it does a couple of things. First of all, it makes the sex industry more palatable for people because they can't imagine themselves engaging in sex work. So they feel that, oh, if women are forced, like it helps them understand it a little bit more, not looking to all the push factors into the sex industry, which may involve things like poverty or lack of transition houses or lack of mental health services, and the list goes on. The other reason I think that the trafficking narrative has a lot of uptake in society is that it creates a role for the listener or the donor. So it's easy, you know, to be an armchair activist. You're sitting in your home, in your pajamas, and you can click on a campaign and donate some money and you feel good about that. But people don't really understand all that well that the support of these campaigns often do a lot more harm than good. And if someone wants to, for example, support a sex worker, that takes a little bit more information. It takes a little bit more work or effort to figure out, well, where's my nearest sex work organization and how do I volunteer or how do I donate? That takes a little bit more work than clicking on an anti-trafficking campaign or showing up for a walkathon or something to support anti-trafficking initiatives.
Mm-hmm. And for the population of women who are in the sex work industry who cannot be defined as being victims of human trafficking, but who simply just don't really want to be doing sex work. They're doing it because the situation in their life has just sort of made that the only route that they can take. What sort of resources do you think should be available to those women so that they are able to make the transition that they want to make? Because I know at this point, although a lot of women may not be actual victims of what we can define as trafficking, they're there because they're in that position because they don't feel that they have the resources to necessarily get out of that position. So do you think that that's something that should be handled by the government or organizations such as yours?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say, you know, for some women, it is a last resort for lack of other opportunities or employment options. However, that's not, I would say, a majority of the people in the sex industry. I mean, the sex industry, especially for a woman, the pay can be very, very high and they can make a lot of money. But back to the folks who are doing it as a last resort, I mean, that comes down to housing resources, equitable pay, like employment standards, more opportunities for women. And with the women that we work with, I mean, there's a whole host of issues where language barriers to in Canada, you know, if you're an immigrant and you don't have English proficiency, I mean, that limits the jobs that you can apply for. If you don't have educational qualifications from another country that are recognized in Canada, again, that limits your opportunities. If you don't have Canadian work experience on your resume, that affects the number of options that are available to you. SWAN just participated recently in some global research with a number of other organizations around the world about social, economic, and labor exclusion for the women we support in Canadian society. So those factors really came to the surface, as well as, you know, immigrants, like in other work sectors, oftentimes they have dependents in their country of origin that they need to send money home to. So when they get here, maybe they need to find a job really fast because their mother or their child at home is waiting for them to remit money back to their country of origin. So it's a complicated situation. but I think more opportunities for immigrant and migrant women to be able to work in the sectors of their choice if they would like would certainly be advisable. But, you know, we have lots of women coming to Canada who come here to do sex work because they know that they can make a lot of money in a very short period of time. So it's not the last resort for those women. It's the first resort. It's the first choice for those women.
Yeah, absolutely. So that is all the questions that I have for you today. I would like to thank you again. That was great. You provided a lot of great insight into that subject. And yeah, we at CITR really value the work that your organization does. So thank you for speaking with us.
Yeah, thank you.
This episode of Intersections is made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Radio Meters program.
Thank you for listening to Intersections, presented by the Gender Empowerment Collective. Tune in again in 4 weeks to catch our next episode. We can always be reached at our email, genderempowerment@citr.ca, for comments, feedback, and topic ideas. Music by Hero.